This is the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio.
Don't sweat the technique.
On the AYG List, I talk with fascinating people. Some at the top of their game, others still climbing. All possessing an uncommon commitment to owning their stories and achieving their vision. I also navigate sometimes complex conversations that unpack and contextualize current events with thoughtful individuals who represent a diverse array of well-informed and passionately articulated perspectives.
Hang out with April on Facebook, peek into her world on Instagram, and follow her on Twitter at the AYG List. Visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog at theayglist.com. And now, April Yvonne Garrett.
Don't sweat the technique.
How does a British-Japanese-Canadian become a contemporary painter whose well-known portraits of women of color illuminate the rawness and urgency of street art? And what non-traditional ways can modern artists share their work to reach a broader audience? How does a painter balance life and art? Contemporary artist Tim Okamura gives us a peek into the mind of a modern-day painter. His work investigates identity, the urban environment, metaphor, and cultural iconography through painting that combines realism, collage, spray paint, and mixed media. Born in Edmonton, Canada, he earned a BFA with distinction at the Alberta College of Art and Design and a MFA at New York's School of Visual Arts. His work is on display in the permanent collections at Wellesley College, the Alberta Foundation for the Arts, and the Toronto Congress Center. His work also resides in the personal collections of actors Uma Thurman, Annabella Sciorra, and Ethan Hawke, and musicians John Mellencamp and the Roots drummer Questlove. Tim, thank you so much for joining me on the AYG List today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and nice to make contact finally. We were supposed to meet last time you were in New York, but I think you ended up meeting our friend Questlove.
Yeah, I didn't even get to see him, which sucks. I mean, I'm bad friend. That's why I try not to come to New York and tell too many people. I'm always looking for somebody, but yeah, I will see you soon. I'm going to be at your show in D.C. I can't wait to see this live. So that brings me to an interesting thing, because I was trying to figure out how in the world you came into my universe, and then I realized we became Facebook friends in like June of 2011. And it was really funny.
Right?
Yeah. And I'm so friend at home, and at this point I really don't care, because you feel like furniture, like you're like family, you're part of like the whole thing that I do now in my social media
All right,
world.
I appreciate that.
Like, I'm really grateful. You're like your comfortable couch. But I think the moment we connected, I remember distinctly being very intrigued by your work. And I spent quite a bit of time looking through your gorgeous portraits. They are just lush and rich and textured and raw and real and urgent, just like me. So there's real kinship to the work. And then I was like, okay, so who is this man? Like, who is he? So I'm like searching for your picture. And then finally I saw your face and I was like, wow, he's really handsome. But let me also be clear that he is not who I thought he was going to be, right? So I'm thinking I'm some brother with some locks, you know, rocking some patchouli that I could smell through like the face wall. And I see this British, Japanese, Canadian dude. And I was like, oh, snap, I got to holler at this dude. I have got to figure out where this work is coming from. So let's start at the beginning. How did your roots in Edmonton, Canada, like all the cultural stuff, all the class stuff, help you define this artistic path?
Yeah, I think a lot of different things fed into it. Thank you for all the nice compliments, by the way, before I continue.
You've earned them. You've earned them.
But no, I appreciate it. No, I think that you know, my experience growing up there was of someone who was considered a little different, being half Japanese. There wasn't a lot of other half Asian kids at that time. And, you know, kids being kids, just like anywhere, anybody who's different gets kind of singled out. You know, I ended up getting into my fair share of scraps, I guess, growing up and being called, you know, every sort of Asian-related blur that kids could think of at that time. And I had a lot of painful experiences, obviously, you know, being a child. But I think as a result of that, I ended up becoming friends with a lot of other kids that were considered minorities or you know, sort of outside the mainstream. And so, you know, all of my friends growing up ended up being, you know, kids from Trinidad or the kid from Guyana that just moved to school who, you know, was feeling out of place and awkward. And of course, I challenged him to a fight his first day of class. And then
look at you,
we've been,
giving it back. Because you were already in that circle,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. You know, it was funny. I was, yeah, just the very first day he showed up, for some reason, I was like, I'm going to fight this kid. And then we fought for a little while, and nothing too serious. And I said, you're pretty tough, man. And he was like, thanks. And then we were just like best friends from that day forward, and we're still
cool.
Good friends. We've been friends now for 30-something years. But so I think that I definitely had this feeling that of not belonging at a certain point in my early years, and through that, you know, like I said, created these friendships with other kids that felt like they didn't belong, and that was sort of something that has informed my view of the world a little bit along the way. The one thing that did sort of make me, I guess, stand out a little bit or, you know, in some ways, you know, change people's perceptions of me was art. And so I was able to, through art and through portraiture, you know, even in like junior high school, kind of, I guess, show that there was more than meets the eye, because I was a huge, gigantic nerd also. But I think
so
that
you
that's
were a nerdy
really what
fighter.
Helped.
You're a
well,
fighter.
I wasn't really a fighter, actually, but, you know, I wasn't ever a willing combatant except for my one friend that I challenged into a fight.
Right, but you had to carry your own in that space. So I'm curious as to how that gets you to, how did you first get a paintbrush in your hand?
Well, I, you know, again, I think, you know, part of just the experience growing up in Canada, you know, the long winters. I mean, I grew up in Edmonton, which is the probably the most populated northernmost city in the country. So we had these winters that started like pretty much in October, and you know, the snow would finally melt away, I would say, by April, May. Mm-hmm. So a lot of time indoors and really, you know, not a lot to do. And if you weren't playing hockey or skiing or, you know, those kinds of activities, you had to basically entertain yourself. And my mother was very much a proponent of pushing me, encouraging, I guess, what sort of early science she saw that I was interested in art. So she got me into and my father as well into painting classes when I was like 10-11 years old. That's when I first started painting, and just stayed on that path. It seemed to be the one thing that I was good at. And like I said, you know, when you're a kid and you're getting positive reinforcement on something that you're doing, it definitely helps. So that's really what kept me on that path.
Right. So when you were studying at Alberta College of Art and Design and then the School for Visual Arts in New York, what were your main sources of inspiration?
I mean, I think I was taking it all in. I was just really kind of a sponge. One of the things that, you know, when it was sort of up to us to choose subject matter for the work, I was also hugely into music at that time. Punk rock was one aspect of things that I loved, but also hip-hop, you know, was really starting to blow up at that point in time when I was you know, in high school and early college. And in some ways, that was my punk rock. That was my, like, you know, music of rebellion. That was the music that captured my imagination. And so I think that really in college is where I started to infuse that as much as possible. I always loved word forms and typography and calligraphy. And so, like, graffiti being, you know, a part of the, you know, one of the sort of pillars of the hip-hop movement. I mean, that was like an automatic, you know, thing that appealed to me. It just clicked. And so I was trying to figure out ways to incorporate graffiti into the work. But I was also, at the same time, interested in portraiture in a traditional sense. But it was always music and art for me. That was always a balance of those two. I played in bands and messed around with singing and every instrument I could try to play it, and I started DJing, and I ended up with a hip-hop radio show in Calgary while I was in art school, which was the only hip-hop show in the city at that time. So we ended up getting all these incredible guests like Ice-T and Will Smith. And
interesting.
So I ended up interviewing Will Smith when I was about 21 years old, right before Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was about to go on the air, and he was on tour with Jazzy Jeff. Yeah. So that was just like a, you know, a time where I was just taking all in music and art, everything. I was just really into just creative energies in general. And I didn't really have a specific idea of where I was going to go at that time, but I knew I wanted to come to New York after that and see, you know, how it all would unfold.
All right. Well, you know, racial constructions have evolved a great deal during our lifetimes. I'm sure you have been asked this question a million times with regard to your ethnicity and the subjects that you are really well known for, mainly being people of color and women of color.
Yeah.
You know, I was wondering, one, how do you respond to questions about your subjects? And two, do you ever get tired of engaging in the conversation about race and your subjects? Has it gotten easier for you? Have you become sort of more compassionate in your response to it? Because it's such a hot button issue, especially in the United States. But as we're evolving and as you've seen the progression of, you know, racial consciousness within all Americans, especially, how has that kind of evolved over time for you?
You know, it certainly is a question that's at the forefront of people's minds. I think that, you know, there's a number of factors that have sort of gotten me to where I am today and a number of reasons that the work ended up becoming what it did. I think that you say, you know, racial consciousness, I mean, for me, it's definitely something that I'd always had in the back of my mind, wanting to have some type of social relevancy to the work. I didn't really specifically set out at any point to say, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I mean, there's actually a Susan Sontag quote, which I just stumbled across recently, but it really summed it all up for me. And her quote said, making social comment is an artificial place for an artist to start from. The artist is touched by some social condition, what the artist creates will reflect that, but you can't force it.
Yeah.
And that's really, that really kind of nailed it for me, because I never sat down and said, what can I do? And, you know, how will this communicate conceptually or any of those types of things? I mean, chalk it up to naivete on some levels. You know, I think that I just said I'm going to paint who I want to paint. I think that we're in a, you know, as a portrait artist and as somebody working in realism, you know, we're sort of in a unique position in the art world in that almost every person feels that they have a valid opinion on the work, as opposed to, let's say, an abstract painter or somebody that's doing installation work where people just don't get it necessarily or don't feel that they're qualified enough to comment on it. But when they see an artist that's painting portraits and painting people in a, you know, in a very highly readable, realistic way that they can have a visceral reaction to, you know, everybody feels pretty comfortable expressing, you know, what their reaction is. And, you know, it's just not something that I, unfortunately, you know, there's not really a short answer, I guess, if I'm to be truthful with it.
Sure.
But, you know, it's something that I never really considered that people would be sort of looking at, not just the work, but also the artist that made the work as kind of this holistic kind of package.
Yeah.
And sort of reading it based on that. And, I mean, honestly, for me, it's all positive and the questions are all you know, to me, a sign that people are interested, that they're intrigued, and that, you know, the work is having an impact, and who I am is having an impact. You know, the fact that, you know, I'm getting feedback that, you know, especially from, let's say, women, you know, like you said, you know, African-American women that are like, wow, like, you've really, this looks like my friend. Like, this looks like somebody I know. I know I don't know them, but I feel that you've really captured you know, something very, very important here. And, you know, that's just a fantastic thing to hear. But, you know, like you said, there's always that kind of surprise. Like, oh, you're making this work because there's a natural association.
Right.
Yeah, there's a pre-inclination to, like, sort of imagine in your head, well, you know, here are some paintings of, you know, black women. Therefore, the artist must be, well, let's just draw the straightest line between two points, a black woman. You know, and then I say, well, it's a man. Okay, well, then, like you said, you know, let me imagine that now. And then, you know, the further twist is it's this half-Japanese guy from Canada. So.
Right.
That's, you know, that does always sort of play into, you know, the perceptions. But I think that that's, I think that's a good thing in the long run.
Well, I think, you know, as you share your cultural and historical narrative with us, that you can really see that the evolution of how we see ourselves as racial beings, as a part of a larger family, that we're not separate from one another and that we are not just kind of dipping in, but we're like really immersing ourselves in cultures that we now share, that you can feel that in your work. And that's what brought me to it. And that's what made me very intrigued by your work. And also kind of, as I got to know more about you, even I'm learning more about you in this interview, but as I got to know more about you and the connections that you have with people and your own commitments, they show up. It shows up in your work. So I'm going to ask you to do something. I'm going to ask you to paint an audio picture for me of how you set the atmosphere to create a new piece of art.
Well, I will try to do that in a moment. But one thing that I did want to say, just as a conclusion, I mentioned that there's always kind of this long answer to that question. But I spoke to a friend of mine that did a TED talk recently about basically the evolution of human consciousness, and I said, there's no short answer, man, to that question, and I get it a lot. And he said, well, there kind of is a short answer. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, the question is, why do you paint black people often enough? And I said, yes. And I said, well, really, your answer is because that question exists.
Nice.
And I thought, man, you
That's right.
Profundity of that statement rings really true. And, and I think that plays into what you just said. And
it's
It is about that kind of evolution where, at some point, it shouldn't ever really, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. In fact, I think it's a good thing. And it's really, something that's constructive, and it's really about furthering the dialogue. But, it's interesting that that is the first question that I'm often asked.
And you just gave me one of those immediate kind of visceral responses to the, you and I are living in that particular moment where that is so, where it's like, oh my gosh, we are living this now. Like, we are the embodiment of the now of that. So, thank you so much
Absolutely.
For circling back around to that.
No, it's okay. Really interesting stuff. And I think it's, like I said, the more sort of the work has gotten exposure, the more, questions are being asked, and the more that I'm, it's a period of self-examination, and it's a period where I really have to verbalize, all these things that I guess I've been thinking or been floating around, in my consciousness. So it's really interesting stuff.
Right.
But as to how I guess you'll have to repeat that question now.
That's fine. There's nothing like a conversation that flows in and out of whatever is relevant in the moment, and that's authentic, and I love that. Okay, so now I'm going to ask the artist to paint an audio picture for me of how you set the atmosphere to create a new piece of art.
Well, I think it changes from time to time. It really depends on what the theme of the painting is. Really the first step in the process for me is having some really broad ideas of some compositions and some content, that I want in a very, like I said, general way.
Mm-hmm.
And then I really start casting, in my mind, who would be good to fit that role, and definitely ask people if they'd be interested in contributing, being a part of the work, and coming to pose. And then I usually set up a pretty informal atmosphere for them to come pose. I just have them over to my home studio, and music is playing, and I'm very good about trying to provide snacks and refreshments. So I'm I'm preparing crudité and cheese plates and whatnot just to be able to eat a little food and just chill with people. And, there's always some music blasting, but, from that point, we'll just kind of start, easing into some different ideas for posing, and I'll, sometimes do some sketches. Long term, I do take photographs, and so it's a pretty quick process. I think maybe one of the more compelling sort of pose sessions that I did was I'm kind of working on this long term series, which I don't know when I'm going to exhibit it, but it's about this sort of fictitious female kind of gang, girl gang, that is fighting for equality, justice, sexual equality, racial equality, all these positive things, but their outward appearance is going to be very aggressive, and they're basically all armed with ancient samurai swords and ancient African weapons, or antique, I guess I should say, that I have in my collection, and so they look like this really kind of underground, scary type of group. So for that particular, or for the few times that I've had models for that, that's when I'm playing more aggressive, listening to Wu-Tang Clan Triumph, and having shots of tequila, and getting everybody into the mood that way. But I think that once people start to get into character, that it all kind of clicks, and the right atmosphere is just kind of comes about naturally. And I think that all the women that I've been lucky enough to work with have really wanted, the ideas that I've brought their way. And in that case, really gotten into the idea of being these sort of female samurais or ninjas, that kind of thing. So I had a lot of fun with it too.
That's cool. You know, artists are generally admired but often misunderstood. You know, there's like, oh, they're loners, they're slackers, they have no vision, they have no business acumen. But your work has shown up in several motion pictures, and it resides in major museum collections and in the homes of more than a few people of note. You were also featured in this documentary, Heavyweight Paint, that really kind of documents kind of the struggle for artists in this day and age to try to stay relevant and definitely financially secure. So how does an artist make that transition from someone who just enjoys their craft to someone who can make a living off of their craft?
Well, you know, for me, it's been nothing but trial and error, really. It's been I'm always on the learning curve. I can never get off the learning curve, it seems.
Right.
The one thing that, you know, is really emphasized when you're going to school, when you are training as an artist, is the creative part of it. You know, all the mm-hmm. formal elements and the, you know, the adult developing ideas and really just kind of, you know, encouraging the creative energy. But there was never, in my experience, enough attention put on the business side of things. Like you say, you know, I fully acknowledge that it's true. Like, you know, many, many artist friends that I know are really not good business people. And I think that you have to sort of force yourself to learn, you know, how to, you know, handle the business side of things. Otherwise, you just end up not surviving. You know, you end up, mm-hmm. You know, with a full-time job, and painting on the side is a hobby. And that's
right.
That's also the case with lots of people that I know that have, unfortunately, you know, at least for now, kind of sort of fallen by the wayside a little bit. You know, part of it for me too is, you know, I think there's just kind of this there's a little bit of a spiritual thing that guides me in that I just believe that this is what I should be doing.
Yeah.
And a lot of the things that you mentioned feel like they've come about not necessarily because of my business acumen, but just because of this sort of idea of, you know, attracting those types of situations to yourself, just
mm-hmm.
more or less based on kind of positive energy and, you know, getting the work out there. And then when I get out there, just sort of being a guy that I think is fairly easy to interact with. And I don't really almost know how to explain it. there's certain things that have just come about that just seem like coincidence, but I know that there's sort of a kind of a higher power, I think, at work.
So you've had some major shows and some shows that kind of put you on the map, you know, Brooklyn, Queens, and you have two current shows of note coming up, one in North Carolina and one in D.C. What do shows mean to you as an artist, and what kind of stories are you trying to tell in these presentations?
Well, you know, every exhibition has been a little bit different for me, and it's you know, that's what keeps me interested and excited, I guess, is there's always sort of a different, you know, impetus behind, you know, whatever I've put together for that particular show. You know, you mentioned the show at the University of North Carolina, which opens September 12th, which is exciting. But that show is actually a collection of, I think it's about 18 paintings that span almost the last 10 years of my career. It really, I didn't grasp the full sort of gravity of that show, that it would end up being more or less kind of a sort of small retrospective of what I've been working on for the last while. And so that show, you know, like I said, the work dates back probably to about 2004 or so. And so a lot of the paintings haven't existed, you know, haven't been in the same room before. I'm really interested to see how they, you know, play off one another. And, you know, for me, it's a little bit of like a, you know, almost like a visual diary in a way. Like, you know, you remember where
that.
You
yeah.
were. Yeah, you know, at a certain point in your life when you're, like, looking at certain paintings and what you were thinking. And, you know, for me as well, there's also looking at, oh, wow, I can't believe I painted that hand, you know,
right.
like that. You know, I would never do that now. You know, things like that that you look at just on a technical level. But so that show is really quite unique in that it is sort of this look back, you know, at a lot of different pieces from different bodies of work, you know, over the years. And like I said, you know, really excited to see that and to experience that in that environment. The show in Washington, D.C. is actually specific to D.C. The gallery there is, you know, very community-oriented. It's a nonprofit gallery that's part of a place called the Smith Center for Healing. And it's basically a center that has arts programs, health programs, yoga, all these types of things that are designed for people, to assist people living with cancer.
Wow.
So the proceeds from the gallery actually go towards, you know, continuing to run the center. And like I said, they really want it to be a community-based gallery, the type of gallery that people that don't know anything about art wouldn't be afraid or intimidated by. you know, in other right. words, they would be very comfortable walking in. So I agreed to, or basically came up with the idea that, why don't I come down to D.C. and shoot models, you know, meet with people there that are all from the D.C. area
mm-hmm.
and really, represent a nice cross-section of women of Washington, D.C. So that's really been a super interesting process. I've actually managed to get a few members of the military close for me, and in particular one woman that's in the Air Force, but she was 9 months pregnant.
Wow.
And so she posed for me. She posed me in her Air Force uniform with, there was kind of these accordion panels on the side of her uniform
wow.
to allow for her expanding belly. So it was really, really cool. I'm doing a profile of her, and she ended up having uh-huh. her baby like 2 days later, actually.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, the timing was amazing. So,
dealing
with some of those subjects really different for me. I also tried to incorporate some of the backgrounds of the U Street area, which has undergone mm-hmm. a lot of gentrification in Washington. You know, I'm very familiar with gentrification, having lived in, you know, several neighborhoods in Brooklyn, like Williamsburg and Dumbo, that have all gentrified, you know, in the last decade or so. To see that also happening in D.C. was interesting. And
right.
that show is called Depicted Connected, and it's about the connection to the environment, but also our connection to each other. So whether it's D.C. or New York or Brooklyn, it's really about always finding that sort of common human connection through all the models.
So how essential is the role of fellowships and gallery acquisitions to your work in solidifying you as an artist of note? Is it even in your mind that you are striving to be a conventional, is there a conventional standard for you being an artist of note, or are you just trying to create that standard for yourself?
Yeah, I think I'm trying to create a standard for myself that, you know, does follow some traditional things to some extent, but just, you know, everybody's on a different path. And
yeah.
I've had some very non-traditional ways of exposing the work, like you mentioned, some of the, you know, the celebrity clientele that I've been fortunate enough to meet and work with.
Right.
I've had my work featured in several motion pictures, which, again, is an unusual route to go, but I think the work has continued to get out there, you know, because of that, because the films have lived on. As far as, like, grants and collections and all those things, I mean, sure, like, those are all things that I'm definitely aspiring to get, you know, in terms of grants or to get placed in collections. It's absolutely, I think every artist hopes to do that, and really, the ultimate goal for me with all that stuff is just to get to a point where, like you said, the finances are stable and
right.
you know, you're not really you know, so concerned about your own survival, and you can actually transition into starting to think about doing projects that now give back. And I'm sort of, you know, getting to that point now where I'm able to think about doing shows that have charity component, where part of proceeds
mm-hmm.
go back, like the show that we did in May called Round Zero with a few other artists that are in the documentary benefited
mm-hmm.
the Brotherhood Sister Soul, which is a charity, a youth organization based in Harlem. And so we were able to give back some proceeds to them, and also have the kids, you know, to the exhibition. Some of the kids from the organization, some of the young members came by, and it was just great to interact with them. And like I said, really feel like there was this exchange now, and that, you know, I've been very fortunate to receive a lot through the through the art, and to feel like, okay, now I can start to give back a bit, and now I can start to get, you know, younger people interested and involved in art is really, that's for me the ultimate goal.
One of the conversations I see you having a lot in your social media space is sort of about the quality of discourse. I noted that one of your favorite quotes is, sometimes one creates as significant an impression by remaining silent. In the current historical moment that we're in, it's I think you really speak to me in a way that you are trying to find your authentic way of expressing yourself as an artist. So do you think it's easier or more difficult for an artist now to find their own voice in this world that seems to be driven by lots of noise and what I will call inelegant clutter?
Yes. I mean, I turned 45 this month, so I've kind of had the benefit of, you know, living in a time where there weren't even ATMs, you know, where you had to go to
right.
the bank and deal with a teller, you know, one-on-one to make
mm-hmm.
deposits or to withdraw money. And now, you know, there's definitely this shift towards, you know, everything's automated. There aren't these personal interactions. And, you know, for me, I'm just curious, you know, almost as curious, you know, as anyone as to how the younger generation of artists, you know, are affected by that. I mean, I see a lot of, I do see a lot of work about communication and about wordplay and you know, even things like dealing with text messaging, and that's part of the work. And I think that, you know, it has had a profound impact. I mean, you know, even myself, like, I don't have as many telephone conversations as I used to.
Right.
You know, now everything is text, and then now people are treating text as if it was email and not even texting you back right away. Texting you back 2 days later. You know, like, there's an email.
What is that?
So that's getting even less, even more kind of almost like walls are being put up, which is interesting.
I can go on for days about emails and text messages. All of my friends know.
Yeah, so, I don't know. I think it is something that people are definitely grappling with. I think it like I said, it is actually the focus of some people's art. You know, and I'm no exception. I mean, I have a solo show coming up in New York, and it's actually going to be called Begin Transmission. Mm-hmm. And that opens in May, and it's really all about communication. So I've been looking into Morse code. I've been buying Morse code keys, and I'm going to make some sculptures and paintings with those. I've been buying walkie-talkies, doing paintings of people doing sign language, and I've actually done my first painting of somebody texting, which I've never done before. So, you know, some of those same things I think, you know, other artists are interested in, I'm interested in too. And I just think that I have a different perspective because I'm, you know, old enough to have seen a lot of these changes, like a lot of these things did not exist earlier. Whereas now, you know, younger artists they're born into that, you know, they're even born into hip hop, you know, which blows my mind, you know.
I know. I feel like, that was like, struggle for us, know, right?
this, I don't know, this huge sort of moment of revelation for me that this whole other creative medium and this whole other world existed, and I saw it, you know, be born, you know.
exactly.
Amazing, yeah.
So if you were not an artist, who would you be?
Well, I've thought about that before, and I the strangest thing is that my answer is that I'd probably be a cop.
Okay, I was not expecting that. Love it. Wait a minute. You got to break that down now. Nobody ever surprises me with their answer for this. I'm always like, yeah, I can see that. Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, well, you know. And then you say that, and I'm like, I didn't. Okay, so you got to break that one down.
Yeah, I just, I always kind of have this thing about justice and things being right. I always felt like, you know, that's a job that I see. I know there's a lot of people look at that job through very often a very negative lens, and there's, you know, a lot of, challenging connotations. But, you know, for me, I always thought that I looked at it through this positive lens of, like, you're helping people. And you're helping them immediately and directly, and you're sorting out situations and, stopping, you know, bad things from happening to people. That's really my very idealized way of looking at it, and that you're not, you know, caught up in the paperwork and the all the red tape of being a lawyer or anything like that. You're just directly out there on the street. Somebody runs up to you, they need help, and you're able to help them. You know, that's kind of the very romanticized idea of why I always thought that would be a good fit for me. But I know that the ideal is not necessarily the reality in some people's experience. But, you know, living in New York, I find, like, you know, I've met a lot of cops here, and I find them, for the most part, to be very normal, very regular people. I've, you know, some cops who were like musicians. You know, this one guy was an awesome rock drummer. Another guy who was an artist, actually, who went through the same program that I did in grad school. And, you know, just for the sensibilities, I think, you know, again, firsthand experience of living in New York and talking to cops here, I just find, you know, there's always this kind of weird connection that I have. I kind of get it, you know, for the most part. But, again, you know, idealized, but I think that my real sort of passion is to help people in some way, and, you know, that's the one way that always was in the back of my mind.
I know that once this interview airs, I know I'm going to have at least 20 people who are going to say, April, why didn't you ask him a deeply personal question? You said you're about to turn 45. I think we might air this before your birthday.
Okay.
In all of the artist space, in all the artists that I talk to, either they are married or in significant relationships, or they are very much seen as loners. And so people are often kind of interested in the interior lives of artists. And I won't tell you, I'm not going to ask you the question about getting all in your business. The question really, though, is more about how do you handle heart issues in the art space?
Affairs of the heart, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because some of the artists that I've talked to, they're just like, you know, sometimes it's really hard to manage because, you know, when art speaks to you, you have to go. And so how is it that you manage, you know, heart issues as an artist?
Yeah, well, it can be challenging for sure. I think that, I think in my case, I have really, the art and the career and just living in New York, I think forces you to make decisions, tough decisions sometimes, like what comes first, what's your priority. And there have been times, and I look back sometimes with regret, but there have been times that I've had to just say, you know what, the art is a priority. I unfortunately cannot, give the time to, this relationship that I know it needs and requires. And, so I've kind of chosen to, continue down that sort of lone wolf path, with just basically my paintbrushes, I don't really overall, like I said, regret, but overall I'm actually, I think the choices I made were correct for me. Mm-hmm. And, it's something I'm thinking about a little bit more lately as I'm sort of getting to what could be the halfway point for me, in my life.
Right.
That the second half would be nice to, to move into some of those more traditional things like marriage and, kids, and I do want to experience that side of life for sure. But I think that, you have to find the right person that understands you as a creative individual and what you need to do, to make your work and to live in a mentally healthy way, does require the artist to have their own space and time. Time is a huge commodity. So, I'll never forget that I had in grad school, one of the guys that was running the program that I went to at School of Visual Arts, he told me, he's like, Tim, you got to find a woman that is okay with the fact that the art will always come first. And she'll support you in that and get it and still be able to love you. I was like, okay. That's been... kind of always in the back of my mind, and I have found, a few people like that, and then I think just the timing, though, wasn't mm-hmm. right for me.
Yeah, and to be fair, you could pretty much insert almost any career into that statement for people who are very, very driven about what it is that they're committed to, so
I think that's true. I think in the case of, being a painter, it just feels like every spare minute could be
a creative moment
by the work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Your work mm-hmm. is just like this gigantic sponge in the middle of mm-hmm. your life that if you don't, run away from it at certain moments, it'll just soak up, all of your time and all of your energy. So it's something that, I'm trying to be more aware of, and I think opened myself up a little bit more to, like I said, the idea of moving on to another phase of life that includes, another person. Hopefully soon. Yeah, hopefully soon.
Cool. So what do you ultimately think at this moment as you are looking at your 45th birthday? I mean, lots of us become introspective when our birthdays come around. What are you thinking right now you want your legacy to be as an artist and as a person?
Honestly, I just hope that I've made some paintings that will stand the test of time mm-hmm. and that they may look like they're specific to a certain era, but hopefully there's something in them, something intangible, something kind of soulful that lasts, leaves a lasting impression. I think that answer is coming, obviously, largely from ego. But, beyond just sort of hoping that I've made some work that lasts and that people still get something out of or want to interact with, let's say, 50 years after I'm gone. Beyond that, I hadn't really thought about it too much. I've just been really just trying to make the best work that I can in the moment. And, I'm more of the mindset that wherever it ends up is sort of out of my hands, and that I'm just going to put the most positive energy into it and try to do the best that I can, in the moment that I'm working. And once that painting is, or once the work is out of my studio, it sort of has to live or die on its own. So.
Wow. Tim Okamura. Yeah. Tim Okamura. I'm so excited that I got this interview with you. I've been wanting to talk with you for the longest time, and you did not disappoint. What a wonderful interview.
Well, I really appreciate it.
So Tim Okamura, soulful, insightful, captivating contemporary artist. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for joining me on the AYG list today. And I will see you at the end of this month.
That sounds great, April. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You've been listening to the AYG list with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio. The AYG list posts every Tuesday and Thursday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. April would love to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter and invite you to take a peek into her world on Instagram at the AYG list. Also, visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog, theayglist.com. Thank you for listening.
Don't sweat the technique.